Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is the show where we take stacks of information, articles, research, and really distill it down into most important, actionable insights for you. Today, we're taking a deep dive into a whole collection of recent news items, and they're all sourced from South Africa's leading technology news website, TechCentral. Now, this is a weekly AI-generated deep dive, and it's curated by the editors over at TechCentral. It's really designed to bring you the most important nuggets of knowledge. And TechCentral is, well, it's simply the best source for reliable technology news in South Africa, definitely the leader in the business technology space. Our main focus today, that's the remarkable momentum of Takilala in South Africa's e-commerce scene and how that connects to the bigger global strategy of its parent company, Prosus. But we've also got some other fascinating topics lined up. We'll look at the surprising overcapacity in China's car market, Oracle's incredible AI-fueled comeback, some crucial solar power funding right here in South Africa, the persistent challenges around government IT procurement, and also the evolving world of drone regulation.
So our mission is to give you a quick, thorough understanding. We'll pull out some surprising facts, key takeaways, really try to cut through the noise for you. All right, let's jump in. Let's unpack our main story. Takilala, a real giant in South African e-commerce. They've just put out some, well, really compelling numbers. What's the headline here?
Yeah, the headline is definitely strong growth, but there's a strategic layer to it. For the year ending March 31st, 2025, Takilala Group reported a 20% jump in revenue. In local currency, that's about 15%. It added over $130 million, pushing their total revenue up past $800 million. And their gross merchandise value, the GMV, which is, you know, basically the total value of everything sold on their platform, a key metric for sales volume, that rose by a solid 13%. That's despite a bit of a slow start to the financial year. And what's also interesting is their gross profit margin improved by one percentage point. Segments like Mr. D Grocery really helped there.
That Mr. D grocery growth is interesting, and I heard the subscription service, Takilala More, is a big part of this overall picture. How important is that loyalty program?
Oh, it's incredibly important. That subscription model is absolutely central to their strategy now. It builds serious customer loyalty, which, you know, directly leads to people shopping more often and bigger order sizes. It creates that sticky ecosystem you need in e-commerce.
Yes.
But here's a crucial point. Despite all this strong revenue growth, their adjusted earnings before interest and tax, the EBIT, basically their operational profit actually slumped to a loss of $12 million.
A loss. Okay, that sounds counterintuitive.
Well, it wasn't really a sign of weakness. It was actually a strategic decision. They doubled down on marketing and infrastructure investments. They're specifically gearing up, preparing for, you know, the competitive pressure from new international players entering the market.
Ah, okay. So it's that classic move. Spend big now to secure the future market. Were there specific things they did, like strategic initiatives to boost their operations?
Exactly right. Part of this strategy involves selling Superbalist.com, which let them focus resources. And they also acquired M24 Logistics, that clearly strengthens their delivery side. And Naspers, Takealot's ultimate parent, seems pretty confident. They expect the Takealot Group to get back to profitability in the 2026 financial year. So yeah, it's a definite long-term play, prioritizing future market share over immediate profit.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, let's zoom out a bit then. Takilala is part of this bigger Prosus empire, which is owned by Naspers. What's the broader financial story for Prosus globally?
Well, Prosus has had some really impressive results globally. Their full-year core headline earnings, they surged by a massive 47% to $7.4 billion. They actually beat their financial targets. Their e-commerce revenue grew 21% to $6.2 billion. And a lot of that growth was driven by advances in artificial intelligence and just general innovation across their portfolio.
Wow, 47% jump is huge.
It is. And what's really fascinating is seeing Prosus shift strategically. They're moving from being just an investment group to more of a like lifestyle tech company. They're actively expanding operations in Latin America, Europe, India. And a really bold move was their agreement to buy JustEatTakeaway.com for 4.1 billion euros. The aim there is to create an AI-powered tech champion in Europe.
That Just Eat deal is massive, and I think I saw something about their cash flow being a big milestone. Can you explain that? What does positive free cash flow really mean for them?
Yeah, you picked up on a really critical point there. A key milestone is definitely their free cash flow. That's the cash left over after covering all operating costs and investments, right? The cash they can use for debt, dividends, or reinvesting. Well, for the first time ever, Prosus's free cash flow, excluding the dividend they get from Tencent, was positive. It climbed to $36 million, up from being negative $235 million the year before.
So they're generating cash from their actual operations now, not just relying on investments like Tencent.
Exactly. It signals a much healthier, more sustainable financial path. Shows their core businesses are really starting to generate cash. And just to bring it back home, Naspers is the South African tech investor that owns Prosus, reported its own massive jump, 59.4% in full-year core headline earnings.
Okay, so putting it all together.
Well, if you connect the dots, it's more than just growth. It really looks like a masterclass in how established e-commerce players are aggressively defending their turf. They're prioritizing future dominance over short-term profits, sort of laying siege against the global competition they see coming, using subscriptions, strategic acquisitions. It's all about long-term growth and profits, setting themselves up very strongly.
Okay, from that dynamic e-commerce growth, let's pivot. Let's talk about another industry facing huge shifts. The global car market, specifically in China. We hear about price wars, but you're saying there's a deeper issue.
That's absolutely right. The price war in China's car market is really just the visible symptom of a much bigger problem. Massive, persistent overcapacity in their car factories. Get this. In 2024, the overall capacity utilization across the entire industry was just 49.5%.
Half?
Less than half.
Yeah, less than half. This is an industry that could make 55.5 million vehicles a year. So more than half their production lines were just sitting idle. And some examples are just staggering. Hema Automobile, they have capacity for 450,000 cars last year. They made just 6,836. That's a utilization rate of
1.5%. 1.5%.
Yeah.
Barely anything.
Barely anything. Even Mengxi Automobile Technology, a premium EV brand, only used 1.9% of its planned capacity. So this extreme underuse is obviously fueling the price war, crushing profit margins, and it has to lead to consolidation eventually. The government's even started openly criticizing the sector for rat race competition.
Oh, no, there are definite exceptions. The market leaders look very different. BYD, for example, ran at a pretty healthy 82.1% utilization while they were rapidly expanding. And they've also been one of the most aggressive in the price war, cutting prices by like up to 34% on some models.
Okay, so BYD's managing. Who else? Well, Tesla's Shanghai factory ran at an impressive 96.1% last year. They serve both China and export markets from there. And Xiaomi, you know, with their super popular SU7 sedan, they ranked up incredibly quickly to 95.5%.
So stark contrast between the leaders and the laggards.
Exactly. And it raises an important point. You know, in Europe or the US, this kind of overcapacity might lead to fairly quick plant closures driven by the market. But China's situation is more complicated. It really shows how tangled government interests and industrial policy can create these economic inefficiencies. Competing national and local government goals often get in the way of simple market-driven consolidation or shutdowns.
That's a really crucial distinction. Okay, from cars struggling to too much capacity, let's shift to a tech story that's almost the opposite. Oracle's incredible comeback. This supposedly dowdy database maker is suddenly hot again.
They absolutely are. It's quite the turnaround. Oracle has become a real investor darling. Their shares soared something like 75% just from their low point in April.
75%. What's driving that?
It's almost entirely fueled by AI, AI-driven revenue growth expectations. It's pushed the stock to, well, technically its most overbought level in 25 years. And its valuation is the steepest in over two decades, trading at 31 times profits.
So the market is really betting big on their AI future.
Hugely. Analysts are now forecasting about 16% revenue growth for the upcoming fiscal year. That's up significantly from 8.4% in fiscal 2025. And net income is projected to rise 15% in fiscal 2026 and then accelerate even more in 2027.
How are they positioned for AI? What are they actually doing?
Well, they're positioned very strongly, particularly in providing the underlying cloud infrastructure. They have that joint venture to provide OpenAI with computing power, which is a massive validation. Really, AI represents Oracle's first sort of material growth avenue in a very long time, after maybe a decade of struggling to find significant new growth areas.
So it's not just hype. It's a real strategic shift paying off.
It seems that way. It's a compelling story, isn't it? How even these legacy tech giants, sometimes seen as, you know, a bit stagnant, can reinvent themselves. They identified this foundational shift AI infrastructure and leveraged their core database and cloud strengths for this new market. Powerful stuff.
Definitely a powerful global story.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's bring our focus back home now. Shifting from those huge international players, let's look at how South Africa is navigating its own tech landscape. There's innovation, but also some persistent challenges. What's the latest in our energy sector? That's always a hot topic.
Indeed. And there is some really exciting news there. Well, Utility, they're a subscription solar service provider. They've just secured 500 million rand.
Half a billion rand.
Yeah, half a billion rand in structured capital funding. And that's from Jaltech. This is substantial funding. They'll use it to deploy a lot more solar and battery systems across the country. It should add over 16 megawatts of solar capacity. Jaltech specifically called Utility a high-impact business with strong potential to reshape South Africa's residential and small and medium enterprise energy landscape.
That's a major vote of confidence.
It really is. It unlocks significant scale for Utility. And of course, it offers a crucial solution for businesses and homes desperate to escape load shedding and just gain some energy independence.
That is fantastic news for energy stability.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, on the perhaps left positive side, let's talk about government IT. Specifically the state IT agency, SETA. There seems to be ongoing confusion, maybe criticism, around recent regulatory changes. What's actually going on there?
You're right. It's a complex picture. SETA is claiming that recent regulatory changes, which were gazetted by the communications minister, Sali Malatsi, have been misinterpreted. SETA is clarifying that government departments still have to approach them first for IT needs. It's only if SETA fails to meet requirements on pricing or turnaround times that departments can then look for alternatives.
Okay, but why the clarification? Was there pushback?
Oh, yes. Strong criticism, particularly from departments like the police and home affairs. They've openly complained about SETA's inefficiencies, slow responses, often higher than market prices, and even subpar security practices. Some departments have even gone as far as seeking exemptions from Parliament to avoid using SETA altogether.
That's quite serious. How is SETA responding?
Well, their stated response includes introducing automation into their supply chain environment. They're aiming for a September launch for that. But, you know, Minister Malatsi himself pointed to deeper issues within SETA, things like corruption, lack of accountability, poor internal controls. He even suggested that sometimes the lack of basic IT architecture isn't incompetence, but maybe a deliberate attempt to obscure accountability.
Oof, that's a heavy accusation.
It is. SETA also pushed back against the idea that they're a monopoly, stating they only meet about 37% of the state's actual IT needs, but they do acknowledge they need to rebuild relationships and really focus on being cost effective. So, yeah, work in progress, perhaps.
A very complex picture indeed. Okay, looking forward now. South Africa has a chance maybe to leapfrog some legacy issues, especially in future mobility. Drones seem to be a key part of that conversation. What's happening there?
You've hit on a really fascinating area. South Africa was actually a pioneer in drone regulation way back in 2015, a decade ago.
Really? I didn't realize we were that early.
We were. But the global market for non-military drones is just set to explode, completely transforming logistics by 2050. And this offers a huge chance for South Africa to leapfrog some of our legacy infrastructure issues, you know, especially where roads are poor or just totally congested. Imagine drones doing fast last-mile deliveries or even transporting medical samples from rural clinics super quickly.
The potential is huge, but regulation needs to keep up, right?
Absolutely. The key thing happening globally is a shift in regulations, moving away from just basing rules on the drone's weight towards a more risk-based approach. This is the policy the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO, adopted from July 2024. Basically, it means a small drone crashing in an empty field is seen as lower risk than the same drone falling in a busy city square, regardless of its weight. It allows for more flexible, sensible rules.
That makes sense. So South Africa needs to adopt that.
Yes, urgently. To stay competitive, allow local manufacturing, allow exports, we need to adopt these international drone classes like the EU uses, C0 to C6. These categorize drones based on weight and operational risk. It makes life easier for regulators and for manufacturers designing drones for specific jobs.
It sounds like a really visionary future, but making aerial mobility part of daily life, that sounds incredibly complex. What are the big hurdles beyond just the regulations themselves?
Yeah, it's not just about the rules for the drones themselves. There are probably three critical things we need to think about to actually integrate this. First, we need to define and categorize vertiports, you know, drone landing spots, micro ones, medium, large ones. And we need to think about practical placement. How do you get true door-to-door service? Maybe hospital rooftops or shopping center roofs become micro vertiports for quick deliveries.
Okay, landing spots. What else?
Second is security. especially for potential passenger drones down the line. You can't just replicate airport security checks. It's not practical. We need streamlined solutions, maybe background checks verified with facial recognition, things like that.
Right. More seamless security. And the third?
Third is just streamlining the rules overall. We need to focus regulatory effort on the high-risk stuff, like flights beyond the pilot's visual line of sight, or passenger drones. And we should adopt proven international frameworks, like the JARIS Specific Operations Risk Assessment, the SOAR framework. It provides a structured way to figure out the risks of a specific drone operation and what safety measures are needed.
So it's about smart regulation, not just more regulation.
Exactly. And if you connect this to the bigger picture, it shows that, yeah, South Africa was a pioneer, but you can't build the future on yesterday's rules. It's really time to modernize, maybe lead again, engage in cooperation like with the EU and other African nations, make sure African voices are heard when global standards are being set. This is our chance to actually shape the future of air mobility on the continent.
So, after all that, what does this all mean for you listening? Across all these different stories, from e-commerce strategy to energy funding, government tech issues, future mobility, there's a common thread, isn't there? It's this rapid technological evolution. It demands constant adaptability, smart strategic investment, and really forward-thinking regulation. Here's a final thought to maybe chew on. Think about how quickly something that seems like magic just becomes mundane, everyday tech. What groundbreaking technology do you think will become totally normal and everyday reality in the next decade? What industry might be ripe for disruption by drones or AI that maybe we're not even thinking about yet? Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Remember, you can get all the South African tech news and analysis you need from Tech Central. The website is techcentral.co.za. And they also have a great daily newsletter. You can subscribe to that at techcentral.co.za newsletter. Definitely worth checking out. Until next time.